Hi, I'm Amanda Borchel-Dunn. Welcome to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Today is Thursday, April 8th, which is Yom HaShoah in Israel, the Holocaust Remembrance Day. I am joined by our Holocaust correspondent from the U.S., from Long Island, in a very early morning call. Welcome to Matt Libavik. Hi, Matt.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Amanda.
Such a pleasure. I will briefly discuss what happens in Israel on National Holocaust Remembrance Day. It begins the evening before, so it began Wednesday night with a national ceremony that takes place at Yad Vashem. And today, this morning, we had a 2-minute national air raid siren, time of standing and remembering and pausing, after which there was another ceremony. So Matt, have you ever been in Israel for Yom HaShoah?
I have been in Israel for Yom HaShoah. The first time would have been 2001. I was a volunteer on a program called Project Otzma, and I must have been in Ramla, outside Tel Aviv, living in Ramla for a few months. And I remember that first sound and thinking, you know, how gut-wrenching it is and how it's sort of pulling something out of you and being so impressed at everyone pulling their car to the side of the road and standing out. I'd never seen anything like that in the world.
Correct. And really the world hits pause, except for my dog, who always sings along with the siren in this very mournful wail that just really gets me in the gut. Now, Matt, you've been writing with us since 2012, really since almost the beginning of the Times of Israel. And basically you are a Holocaust correspondent. Here and there, I will get you to write different things outside of the tchum, outside of the realm of Holocaust, but really your heart and soul is in this field. How did you get into this particular field?
I would say, like many other people who write about it, it comes from family roots. It comes from, as a kid, hearing my Bubby and Zadie, my father's parents, you know, were in this thing called the Holocaust. And like a lot of kids, having a lot of curiosity about it, but not hearing any kind of facts from them or details from them. So I think my road on this being what I write about and Holocaust memory, a lot of it comes from the initial deep curiosity and kind of the shame that pervaded a lot of, you know, families around talking about it and the desire to not, you know, pass on to the grandkids what is seen as like a painful or shameful legacy. But that did leave a lot of people, such as myself, with unanswered questions and the need, you know, to learn more. And for the Times of Israel, it was kind of an incredible thing, actually, when the Times of Israel began getting published, because after many years of absorbing and reading literally hundreds of books on the Holocaust and dozens of films, I won't say hundreds of films, probably dozens of films, it was the first time with the Times of Israel that I was able to put it back out there, to sort of to process it, to have a platform that would be open to creative interpretations and doing things, you know, and writing interesting articles about the Holocaust. So that's just been really incredible, being able to take those years of kind of research and to be honest, to work with real people, even especially like when you study the Holocaust, obviously it does, you know, get depressing. It's sad. It's heavy. And something at the Times of Israel is, you know, you're writing about this still, but you're also talking to professors and scholars and researchers and archaeologists and other people. And it felt like kind of like a completion to years of research.
Among your hundreds and hundreds of really creatively pitched and creatively angled stories are several that are deeply personal. And one of them, in fact, is how I found my Bubby in the Auschwitz album. This came out several years ago, and it was the culmination of several years of research, actually, which I was very, very happy to publish on our site. Tell us a little bit about this particular personal journey.
Sure, that's a great question. So my Bubby, Bella Libavik, my father's mother, I had known she was in the Holocaust, but she never told her stories. And I just kind of knew the word Auschwitz, and I kind of knew the word Czechoslovakia. Only after she passed away in 2007 did I actually watch her testimony that she gave to the USC Shoah Foundation, founded by Steven Spielberg. So once again, it was really only a few years ago that I sit down and I watch the videotape testimony, and I learned that, you know, it wasn't, first of all, Czechoslovakia. It was Hungary during the war. And I just start to learn, you know, I learned the name of her town, and I learned what, you know, details. And eventually, I really wanted to find a photo of her. And I just was scouring archives. And then I was always aware of the Auschwitz album, which, to tell you really quickly, the Auschwitz album, it's a collection of about 200 photos that were taken by a photographer with the SS, but he took them of the arrival of Jewish Hungarians one day in April 1944. And to immediately correct myself, it actually wasn't one day. The article I wrote for the Times of Israel, I really got into some of the myths and confusion about the album. It was actually several transports over a few days. Anyway, to narrow down the story back toward my grandmother, I realized that there was a chance she could be in this Auschwitz album thing just by virtue of reading the captions of the people in the album and where they're from, because we actually know the names of about 70% of the people in those photos. So I said to myself, wait a minute, these are the Hungarian Jews. These are the people who got there in April and May of 44. My bubby could, she was on one of these transports, like she could actually be here. And so I re-examined the photos, and then I came upon one I'd seen many times on the wall at Yad Vashem, because it's one of the most interesting photos, because it's of a girl smiling. It's of like an impish looking, very thin girl smiling at Auschwitz. And I saw myself in her right away. Like, it looked like me. There was a huge front space between her front two teeth, the likes that I had before I got braces, and the way her head was tilted and the way she smiled. But I would say, more importantly, to weave the story together accurately, I needed to listen to her testimony before I could see her in the photo, like, not just because I needed to figure out the geography, but even frankly, to hear her describe herself as a young girl who every year got a Passover dress that the aunts made, and the dress fit her. She said, you know, she was thin as a rail, and she was running off and always like where she shouldn't be and kind of getting yelled at. And, you know, in the picture, like, her testimony about herself is evident in the photo. It popped out, because here is a girl who doesn't have a star on. Most of the women and children in these photos have a yellow star on. They were forced to wear. She has no jacket on. She's kind of showing off her dress. She has the impish grin. And that's what really made it actually kind of even more interesting and special to me.
Hi, it's Sarah Tuttle Singer from the Times of Israel. Come join our community and support fast and fair independent journalism. You can sign up with the link at the bottom of every single article on the site.
Now, another journey that you've been on for decades, I would say even, is your quote-unquote obsession with Anne Frank. Can you tell me how that began and how it's been reflected in your work for us at the Times of Israel?
Yeah, like so many people around the world, Anne Frank was a main introduction. Like I said, I was reading those kind of adult books, but I was also being introduced to Anne Frank, really, at, you know, in religious school, a Jewish religious school in third grade, maybe second grade. So she immediately fascinated me, and I would say the main reason I've stayed interested in Frank is, frankly, just because she's such a touchstone. It's kind of remarkable that so many thousands of books and plays and poems and movies have come out of Anne Frank, who didn't live to see 16 years old. And, her writing is amazing, but it's certainly not, you know, we can't say it was prolific. You know, all of these books and movies and things are coming out of someone who, you know, had a small body of work as a young person. So I've just enjoyed following how her memory has evolved. And it's not a static story. As if people who follow my reporting, if you want to type in my name and look at the Anne Frank articles, I've probably written about 20. Things come out, things evolve. For example, historians found a hidden page About a year and a half ago in her diary with text that she wrote that no one ever knew about because the pages were kind of pasted together. There are photos coming out of her sister. Her sister doesn't get a lot of attention, unfortunately, Margot. But Margot also kept a diary, believe it or not, that history doesn't have. But a photo came out of her. I was really excited a year and a half ago because, you know, it's photos come out and no one has ever seen them, yet you feel like you've known someone since you were a kid, you know, which is to say Anne Frank's sister. And then a photo comes out of her, you know, rowing with her rowing team in the Amstel River and in a bathing suit and smiling. And it's like, it's kind of like an incredible photo to really restore your image of what she, you know, what Anne Frank's sister was like before the war and what her hobbies and interests were. And it's completely the kind of photo that you don't, you know, expect to see or that you haven't seen. And so it's always evolving. The thing about Anne Frank and covering it, there's, you know, there's discoveries and things that are found.
Now, one of the things that gives your reporting such depth is that you've actually been to many of the camps, the transit camps, the concentration camps, the extermination camps. And so you can add in details that most armchair reporters are not able to do. Tell us just slightly about your journeys to all of these camps and how that began.
Sure. Well, it was one of those things where I wanted to go for many years to visit these places I was reading about, but I wasn't ready yet. I actually kind of became ready around the same time I started writing for The Times of Israel. In 2012, I took part in a program. It's called Germany Close Up. And what they do is they're trying to sort of build bridges and, how do I say, they're trying to bring over people like me whose parents maybe said, I will never go to Germany. I will never buy a German car. Like, I feel like I was the program's audience because I too was someone who wasn't ready to travel to Europe in that context. Then I heard about this program, like tailor-made for me, you know, called Germany Close Up. And I would be a guest of the German government for a week. And we'd really learn about memory work and how, you know, Germans are remember the Holocaust and have taken responsibility in the world today based on their own past. So that Germany Close Up program was very pivotal to me because not only was it my first time really in sights of the Holocaust, but I went to my first concentration camp, which is called Sachsenhausen. Sachsenhausen is outside of Berlin near Oranienburg or in the town of Oranienburg. And it was a good first kind of camp to visit. I didn't have any family ties to it, like a bunch of the other ones I later went to. So yeah, my visits to these places, it's been a long-term curiosity and to see what they're like. But as I've said, it's also what's going on. Like, what are the debates? How is memory being taken care of? For example, at Auschwitz-Birkenau, the most famous, the most notorious death camp, there's a new museum coming probably next year or the year after, and that's going to be a tremendous deal because at Auschwitz-Birkenau, they receive, I believe, before the pandemic, 2 million visitors a year. So that's, you know, what museum they have there on the grounds that 2 million people see is significant, and it matters. Similar to Anne Frank, I see following the death camps and developments on the ground, and this, who takes care of, you know, memory. And it's been, you know, it's not static, and you learn a lot about these countries and about memory and how people relate to those places.
One of the other series of articles that you tend to work on for us is connecting the history of the Holocaust to contemporary issues. There are several pieces that you've done in this vein. One of them came out last year when you were talking about the Tulsa mob massacre of 300 blacks in 1921. You also wrote a fascinating piece recently about Levittown, which was such a racist, anti-Jewish place of a series of neighborhoods, insta neighborhoods that were developed by the Jewish William Levitt. Tell me a little bit about how you connect the contemporary to the historical.
Sure. It's been one of the great, I think, the word joy sounds weird to use about writing about the topic, but one of the reasons I've always been so engaged and interested in this topic is because of its relevance to events today and how it's sort of a difficult topic, but that if people can tap into it, they can find resilience and they can find lessons for history. So I think one, for me, you know, writing about the Holocaust, I'm always trying to have what I write, you know, be somehow reflected in terms of what's going on in the world. So it's been, you know, having started in 2012, I can certainly say that the past 2 or 3 years, you know, being based here in the States, have been remarkable and incredible with things like Black Lives Matter and other movements that have swept the country. It's been a great opportunity for me to angle some of that writing for echoes to be heard. So I think the Holocaust for me is it doesn't always show as strongly in the article, but every single time I write about the Holocaust, I'm thinking of something today and someone had a great quote about writing once. Of course, I forgot who it was, but they said that it should bear down on the present. Like, good writing should bear down on the present. So sometimes it's really easy for me, for instance, like the Tulsa riots and looking like a pogrom, that was a really, I thought, easy comparison. And sometimes it's more, you know, it's more obscure, like elevating women in a story where women voices have been marginalized, maybe even talking to the descendants of perpetrators, like the grandchildren of Nazis.
Matt, thank you so much for joining us today. Really, really insightful conversation, and keep up the great work. I feel so blessed to have you on our team.
Thank you. And I feel blessed too to be writing for the Times of Israel. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. A special thanks to our producer, Raoul Woodliff. I'm Amanda Borshaldan.
You can find us daily wherever you get your podcasts.
And on our mothership, thetimesofisrael.com.